I'd like now to welcome Jonathan Overpeck. He is a paleoclimatologist. He's Thomas R. Brown Professor in the Department of Geosciences and the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And he's co-director of the Institute of the Environment. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
So we talk about climate change a lot in the media, and there are a lot of things that people already know about how climate change works and how it's progressing. What are some of the symptoms of climate change that we're seeing and that we're seeing more and more these days?
Well, at this point in time, we're kind of seeing everything that folks predicted would occur decades ago. We're seeing a lot of warming, and the Southwest is warming faster than any other part of the United States outside of Alaska. We're seeing a drying out because of the warming, but also because we're getting less precipitation, particularly in late winter and spring. We're seeing more extremes, so we'll see more drought. And I think we're also, at least at the global scale, seeing more intense rainfall. And a good example, that's what happened up in Colorado this year. It's the kind of storm that will be more frequent in the Southwest in the future. And all these things, again, were projected to occur. They are occurring, and that gives us a lot more confidence that they will continue to occur and only get worse, of course.
When you talk about warming, where do you put the thermometers? Are they in the air? Are they in the water, in the ground? Are they in cities, in rural lands? Where do you read them?
Well, climate scientists are pretty cautious a lot. And to really understand what's going on, we basically put thermometers everywhere. You know, we can measure temperature from space up in the all the way through the atmosphere. We can measure it on land. We can measure it inland. We can measure it in the ocean and at great depths in the ocean. And what we see is everywhere in the lower atmosphere on down is warming up dramatically. And up in the upper atmosphere or the stratosphere, it's cooling because these greenhouse gases that are trapping the heat in the lower atmosphere are preventing that heat from getting back out to space via the upper atmosphere. So it's giving us a really clear fingerprint that the warming is due to these greenhouse gases that are emitted primarily by burning fossil fuels.
Because if it were coming from the sun or somewhere else, then the stratosphere would be warmer.
Exactly. You'd see a different, completely different signature. You'd see the whole atmosphere warming up, and we don't see that, and very clearly don't see that.
So when we talk about symptoms of climate change, is climate change, is global warming like an illness? Is it like a literally like a fever? We're measuring its temperature?
I think that metaphor works because it's very important when you're talking to a doctor and you say have a fever to understand what's causing that fever. You'd want to know because you want to be able to adapt to that fever, you know, if it requires putting cold packs on your forehead or sleeping more. But you also want to make sure that you get the right medicine to get rid of the fever. And so climate change is much the same. We want to know what's causing it so we can anticipate what's going to happen in the future so we can adjust our ways of operation to do better in that new climate. But we also want to know the cause because it might get out of control. And if we know the cause, we can then mitigate or, in this case, reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, reduce the fossil fuel burning.
I can't help but think, when you think about the human immune system and then you look at natural carbon sinks like the oceans and forests and so on, that those absorb the excess carbon, but only up to a point. And you can stress out your immune system to the point where it's not going to keep you healthy anymore.
Yeah, that's good. You know, the climate system does have a natural capacity to self-regulate and self-heal. And fortunately, the vegetation and the ocean are taking up some of the CO2, and the ocean's taking up a huge amount of the heat, 90% or more.
But 90% or more of that excess heat is going to the ocean.
Is going to the ocean. It's mixing down deep into the ocean. And that's really lucky for us because it means that the atmosphere is not warming up as much. But as we stabilize and hopefully reduce greenhouse gas emissions and greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere, the Earth will want to start cooling off, and what the ocean will do is release that heat. So whatever temperature it is, whatever climate we've got, when we finally stabilize the greenhouse gas emissions down to zero, that's the climate we'll have for hundreds of years, probably over 1,000 years.
Now, what would make it stabilize, either when we burn every last bit of carbon in the ground and put it in the air, or when we make policy so that we stop doing that, basically?
Those are our choices. Yeah, and it's hard for me to imagine that we'd burn all the fossil fuel we've got in this earth. It would just be ridiculously altered earth. And I can't imagine anybody, even in the halls of the oil industry, think that they can burn all that and get away with it. I mean, it would just be...
Or the coal industry.
It'd be devastating. So the big question is, how much are we going to burn before we finally try to stabilize it and reduce those emissions to zero?
So these carbon sinks, like the oceans and the forests, how are they actually doing? I mean, you say the ocean is absorbing an awful lot of heat, but that's having an effect on the ocean and its many inhabitants.
Yeah, in the case of the ocean, it's particularly bad because all that CO2 going into the ocean, not counting the heat, just the CO2, is causing the ocean to become more acidic. And we're seeing that occur, and that is having effects already on organisms that live in the ocean and, of course, food chains that are related to those organisms. So that's one thing we're seeing. And then we see all this heat going to the ocean, and that, too, is affecting ocean currents. It's certainly causing the ocean to expand like a hot air balloon, and that's raising sea level. But it's also affecting the biology of the ocean and critters that live in the ocean. So this isn't at all good for the ocean, even though kind of out of sight, out of mind. But we know from science that it's having big effects on the ocean.
What's happening to some of those critters? What are some examples?
Well, I think it's a really charismatic or iconic problem is the effect it's having on coral reefs. And as coral reefs get too hot, they have a symbiotic relationship with algae that lives in the coral polyps, and those symbionts often get expelled from the coral, and then the corals bleach. And once they bleach, they're more susceptible to erosion. And so you see a lot of coral reefs around the world degrading significantly, in part because of this really anomalous warming. It's, of course, there are other influences on that too, like overfishing and tourism and things like that. But the warming is having a big effect. Another iconic problem in the oceans, what's going up in the Arctic, where marine mammals are having are getting affected in big ways, because up there the warming is the greatest, and it's really affecting the sea ice that covers the ocean much of the year. And the marine mammals are adapted to that sea ice. So, as are polar bears that eat the marine mammals.
Yeah.
So that whole ecosystem is undergoing a pretty whopping change now. And it's unclear, because we don't understand everything with these ecosystems, how it's going to play out.
We're talking to scientist Jonathan Overpeck. So we can talk ad infinitum about the scary and ever more likely scenarios like sea level rise and the arable lands of our country and our world turning into deserts and food shortages and water shortages and so on. And a lot of people are talking about adaptation to whatever the new reality is, as opposed to mitigation, which means stopping putting so much carbon into our atmosphere and stabilizing the climate so that it's something like what we've known for many thousands of years. What is adaptation? I mean, to me, like in this disease metaphor, it's like treating the disease rather than preventing the disease. But what does adaptation actually look like? What are adaptation strategies that people are doing or considering?
Well, it's dealing with the symptoms, for sure, rather than the cause. And we're going to have to do it no matter what, because we all know that we can't instantly turn off these greenhouse gas emissions. We can't instantly get out of fossil fuel. So we're going to get a good deal more climate change regardless.
And even if we did, it wouldn't just revert to the way it was, let's say, 50 years ago.
No, we're stuck with the climate that we've got for a long time, unless we want to make it change even more away from that natural baseline. And so adaptation strategies are already being employed around the world to deal with the warming and the drying and a lot of the other changes that are occurring. The sea level rise is a good example. The U.S. Navy is spending a lot of effort now figuring out how to adapt to changing sea level around the world. And it's going to cost taxpayers a lot of money. And, of course, a lot of the adaptation we're doing out here in the Southwest is going to cost all of us a good deal of money. We're adapting to more fire. We're adapting to less water. These things are not trivial when it comes to cost, and these costs will just continue to mount. Then, of course, as we do adapt and come up with plans for adapting to the worst change that's down the pike, we'll start to get a clearer picture of what we cannot adapt to. Either it's too expensive, or literally it just can't be adapted to. You know, if you live on an island, say, and 3 feet of sea level puts that island underwater, it may be nothing you can do. And so you would say, I don't want it to warm so much that we get 3 feet of sea level rise. The same might be true in parts of the Southwest where water supply will literally get to the level where we can't do a lot of the things we now do in the Southwest. So adaptation is a good way to learn about what levels of mitigation we really need. In other words, we can only treat the symptoms so far. Where do we actually have to jump in and spend the money to cure this disease?
It's so ironic because jumping in and spending the money to cure the disease right now, like putting money into, for example, energy storage, alternative energy, and so on and so on, would save so much money down the line when you think about what is going to have to be spent adapting to in a kind of stumbling and bumbling way, because it's not going to be a pretty picture adapting to climate change.
True, and I think it's even worse than that. You know, right now you have the fossil fuel industry spending a lot of money to ensure that we, with their lobbyists and such, ensuring that we don't do anything on climate change. And we don't get into low carbon energy, solar and wind and other forms of sort of new next generation energy. That is going to be very costly for us, as you just said. But we're also missing the boat on being the country and the region of the country that is developing these technologies and these solutions that will be marketable around the world. So if you look ahead at what are going to be maybe big economic engines of the future, it's not going to be fossil fuel. It's going to be these new energy solutions. It's going to be the new water solutions. How do we use water more efficiently? How do we reuse water? These are the things that are going to make people in America, or maybe in other countries if we keep our head in the sand, rich. You know, this could literally be a major economic engine that right now, a few industries don't want us to spend time on because it's antithetical to their business model.
I don't know why they're not going into that business.
You know, I think you saw back 20 years ago a number of the oil giants get into renewable energy. And you still see them playing around with biofuels and things. I think the problem is that you can make so much money so easily, you know, drilling for oil, that they just as soon do that for as long as possible and rack up the profits that way and not get into these more risky next generation energy solutions.
Right. Thereby putting the entire rest of the world in at much more risk.
True. But, you know, I think they would say, you know, this isn't about ethics or being nice. This is about making money for our shareholders. And, right. You know, that's clearly what's going on here.
We're talking to Jonathan Overpeck. So when we talk for a moment about mitigation, what are the basic ways to mitigate, halt, slow down, reverse climate change that are available to us?
There are a lot of ways, and they all, of course, focus on reducing our greenhouse gas emissions to zero. The biggest culprit in the global warming and climate change is CO2, and the emissions of CO2 are primarily driven by the burning of fossil fuel. So the best thing we could do right off the bat is get out of coal. And you can see in the United States, our use of coal is going down pretty steadily, in part because natural gas, which is less bad for the climate, is now cheaper than coal for energy. You see this going on in China. They're slowing down their development of coal, in part because of the gas, part because of climate change, but also part because the pollution associated with coal is a lot worse than other energy solutions. And even in the United States, if you go up to Four Corners, for example, the air there is pretty polluted. You go to Phoenix, the air there is pretty polluted. It's not good for our health. That's why people are getting a lot more respiratory illness and things. So by getting out of coal, we can help with climate, we can save money, and we can have cleaner air to breathe. So it's kind of a no-brainer. But we still have a lot of oil that we can burn, and you start looking at things like tar sands and some of these unconventional oil sources, fracked oil. We have tons of oil we can still burn, and we're going to have to reach the point where we stop burning that oil as well. And yeah, we'll still need oil for some specialty things like plastics and other things, but using all this oil to make fertilizer, using all this oil to generate energy, is doing a lot of damage to our climate system.
You know, it's I think it's also important to point out that there are some really good uses for petroleum that isn't burned. I just think of the shirt I'm wearing, which is polar fleece, and it's made of petroleum. And there's a lot of plastics and things like that that, I mean, I'm not talking about plastic water bottles, but really useful products that it would be kind of a shame if we burned it all.
Yeah, well, we're not going to run out of oil. There's no, I'm a geologist. I don't think there's any sign of running out of oil. And this whole argument about peak oil is kind of a distraction. We just have to pay more and more for that oil as it gets more and more expensive to extract. And we can do that. But nonetheless, it isn't the cost of oil that is going to drive us out of the oil era. It's going to be the economic cost. It's going to be the climate cost. It's just going to start to rack up these climatic changes that are unacceptable. And people like to joke. I think it was a Saudi oil minister back in the 70s that we didn't get out of the Stone Age for the lack of stone. So we're going to leave some of that oil in the ground. And the problem we have, of course, is that there's very powerful, rich companies that want to leave as little in the ground as possible. And they'll do whatever they can, it seems, to maintain status quo, even to the point of trying to say that the science is a hoax and the climate science is a hoax and that scientists don't know what they're talking about. Of course, scientists know what they're talking about. It's crystal clear what's going on with the climate system and why. It's just a big propaganda effort to slow the inevitable change to these newer energy sources that are less harmful to the environment.
How has the climate change denial movement, which has been a product of basically of the fossil fuel industry, how has it affected your work and the way you present your work, if it has?
Well, I mean, I think it makes me, and I'm probably speaking for quite a few climate scientists, more willing to get out and talk to the public, and to help compensate for the misinformation that's being spread. So the more they try and spread disinformation, the more climate scientists are going to speak out and try and make sure that the population understands what is at stake, what's happening. It's not the job of scientists to say, to prescribe policy. Our job is to make sure we have an open and scientifically well-founded debate. So the ironic thing here is the more they push, the more we push, and it's kind of a unfortunate waste of time.
As the clock ticks.
As the clock ticks, and that's all they're trying to do. They did it, the same kind of people did it with tobacco. They've done it with acid deposition, and they did it with CFCs. They've done it with just about every environmental issue, and they're always wrong in the end. But they can consume time and rack up profits during that time. The other thing the climate denial community and their funders are doing is they're literally attacking scientists, trying to make our lives more miserable. That's just kind of the cost of being a scientist these days, a climate scientist. I didn't anticipate that, and I think it's really sad that these otherwise highly reputable companies and people are stooping to such tactics. But they're obviously quite desperate, and they're going to do this kind of stuff. And as a scientist, I just have to, it's part of the job now.
So it's turned a lot of scientists into basically activists of one kind or another.
Well, we're activists in terms of trying to make sure the public understands the truth. We're not activists in terms of trying to tell the public what to do. And that's an important distinction.
So you don't really weigh in on public policy?
Well, I weigh in the sense that I'm a citizen just like you are and everyone else is, and I feel it's my right as a citizen to say the way I feel. But I want to be real clear when I'm talking about my opinion versus when I'm talking about the science, you know. And so I have kids, and I feel it is morally reprehensible to bequeath them a world that is much worse than I was given by my parents. And I feel it's wrong to submerge whole island nations with sea level rise when these island people on these island nations really did nothing to contribute to climate change. I feel it's wrong to essentially deny native people in the Arctic their subsistence culture, which really is what holds their culture together, because of climate change. I think morally, it's the wrong thing to do. And I'm willing to say that. I think it's important to say that. But, you know, when it comes to deciding what to do, I'm just one citizen, one vote. And we all have a seat at this table. And I just want to make sure that everyone knows what the science is. And, you know, that what they're saying on Fox News and some of these other crazy places, you know, is just, it's a bunch of bull.
We're talking to climate scientist Jonathan Overpeck. I was talking to somebody who's very dear to me who was railing in favor of energy independence, which meant getting all the oil possible out of the tar sands and doing fracking and all of that. And she was involved with an organization that plants trees to absorb the carbon that we're putting into the air, planting trees as a way of mitigating climate change. And I thought, I mean, I don't think I'm capable of doing the math on that, but the number of trees you'd have to plant to absorb the energy that gets burned if we open up all those Canadian tar sands, it seems like that's the numbers that you would have to plant.
A fool's errand.
It's a fool's errand. You could never plant enough trees.
You could never do that. You're right. And it's not bad, though, to plant trees. It's not bad to prevent deforestation from proceeding as it's been. And because not only does it help with the climate system, it also helps with things like biodiversity, which people care about. So it's a good thing to do.
What about other strategies that people talk about for mitigating climate change, like geoengineering, cloud seeding, some of those sort of high-tech solutions?
Well, cloud seeding is something that's done routinely for weather purposes. And in the winter, you can cloud seed and sometimes get a little more snow out of a storm. That's quite different from some of the other geoengineering ideas that have come forth. A good example of one is that we could mimic a continuous volcanic eruption. And during volcanic eruptions like Pinatubo back in the 90s, when that occurred, we knew in advance it would cool the climate, and it did, because it puts these reflective particles up in the upper atmosphere. But eventually those particles rain out, and the Earth comes back and warms up. And we could, though, artificially keep those, we call them aerosols, those particles up in the stratosphere for as long as we want and cool the Earth that way. It's a crazy idea. And it's crazy because the ocean would keep acidifying, because the CO2 levels would keep going up, and that's what's acidifying the ocean. And it would also leave us vulnerable to a real catastrophe if somehow the artificial volcanic dust loading in the upper stratosphere ceased all of a sudden due to some war or some other technical aspect. And you also have to factor in that what country would control this system? You know, if we controlled it, we could decide where it's more likely to rain and not rain around the planet. And if some other country, say China, all of a sudden had a horrible drought, even if we didn't cause it, they might think we caused it if we were controlling these volcanic, this artificial volcanic aerosols. And you can just imagine all sorts of problems that would emerge. And it's just crazy to treat one human experiment with the Earth's atmosphere and climate system with another crazy one that could have all sorts of unintended consequences, just as global warming can have unintended consequences. I mean, there are always surprises occurring. The Arctic is melting faster than we thought it would melt. We could trigger a mega drought, a drought that lasts 50 years in the Southwest. We've had them. Maybe we'd have them again in the future. It's probably a good chance we will, only they'll be a lot hotter. You know, we're just playing with fire here, literally, to let this go as it's going now.
When you look at other countries that are putting climate change policy in place, who do you think is doing a good job?
Well, right now, believe it or not, the United States is doing a better job than most people give us credit for. The current administration, Obama administration, has made some huge cuts in our emissions, and he's been lucky because he's had this conversion from coal to natural gas that's going on because natural gas is now cheaper than coal. But he's also changing the emission standards for automobiles and other vehicles. That's having an effect. He's also putting into place, you know, emissions efficiency standards, also renewable energy. There's a lot of things going in the United States that actually makes us look pretty good right now. But of course, there are other countries in Europe in particular that have been doing quite a bit more. What I find most interesting is that it appears that China is starting to get real serious about reducing its carbon emissions. I was just there recently, I was amazed to see students protesting about global warming. So the central government is clearly, that's a sign that they want to deal with this problem. And they want to deal with it because the air pollution is so bad, but also because climate change is clearly having some bad effects on China. You know, they're getting less rain and they really want to feed themselves. So I think China is likely to emerge as a real actor here. And I think part of that is driven by the fact that they realize, they're run by engineers and businessmen, not by a bunch of politicians working for industry. They realize that they can be the ones to capture the economic market of climate change solutions of the future.
Which, as a little while ago you said, we were precisely not doing.
Exactly. We're ceding this to China. You know, you look at solar panels, for example. They've taken over that market, but I think there's going to be just this huge raft of other technologies. How do you generate the electricity? How do you move the power around? How do you store the energy? How do you make everything we do in life more energy efficient? How do you make everything we do in life more water efficient? How do we reuse water? All of these technologies are going to be what drives the economy of the 21st century. And China, I think, has got that, and they're going to position themselves to be the big winner. Europe is certainly, Germany in particular, is moving that direction as well.
And Germany, where there's like 4 sunny days per season.
Yeah, but they understand that it's not just about Germany and their energy crisis. It's about a world market for entrepreneurship and technology and knowledge solutions. And, you know, we have a chance to do that in the United States, but the odds are stacked against us when we have politicians who are, you know, using crappy scientific advice to essentially ignore a big problem and ignore action on a big problem.
You are a scientist and have been looking at the issue of climate change for a long time. Science is very good at making models, making predictions, making their models ever more accurate. What is the role of science in finding solutions to the crisis that we're in?
Well, science is a big a big endeavor. You know, they're the climate scientists. And when people suggest certain solutions for cutting the causes of climate change, you know, the climate scientists is a part of that mix and using the climate models, trying to figure out the most cost-effective ways to mitigate climate change is a big job for climate scientists, but it's a big job for other people as well. It's a big job for the land managers who can actually use land, such as the trees we were talking about, planting trees, but also the soil and the way we do agriculture, to release less carbon back to the atmosphere, to keep more of that carbon in the vegetation and in the soils. And then there's a whole host of, you know, advanced technologies that are going to require a lot of science. And it might be science that's way beyond climate science. It's chemistry, it's optical science, it's physics, it's bioscience, working on other types of fuels that don't put more carbon in the atmosphere. You know, and these things are all very active within our universities.
Energy storage.
Energy storage is another great one. You know, so engineers are very important in this mix, not just scientists. And social scientists as well, because a lot of these technologies have implications for society beyond just the, you know, the obvious technological solutions. It's how do you get society to adopt them? How do you make sure that they don't have unforeseen negative consequences in society? You know, it's a big job for a lot of people, but the cost is undoubtedly very small compared to the cost that we're going to incur if we let this climate change just go on and on unchecked.
I heard you give a presentation at the Kivira Coalition Conference, and you said at the end that you were optimistic. What drives your optimism?
I think the most important thing is when times get really tough, the American people, and I read a lot of history. I was almost a history major. But it's really clear when times get really tough and we are faced with a really big problem, the American people can get very clever and can work very hard to solve the problem. And I think it's only a matter of time. You know, it might take a major U.S. city on the coast getting destroyed by a storm like the typhoon that just hit the Philippines. It might take a drought that's much worse than the ones we've been having lately. Believe it or not, they could easily occur to change public opinion here and to say we got to change this, fix this, and we got to fix it fast. And fortunately, many of the technologies that we need to do that are already available. But it's the American ingenuity and just the American way of solving problems that I have a lot of optimism in. And of course, we're going to be challenged by China and Europe and Japan, Australia, some of these other countries that have a lot of talent as well. And there's this competitive spirit in America that I think will also kick in when we start to realize that we're having our clocks cleaned and setting up for the future economy of this 21st century. We'll see a lot of action. We'll see quick action, and I just hope we see it soon, or else we're going to have to endure a lot more negative impacts of climate change.
Jonathan Overpeck is a paleoclimatologist. He is Thomas R. Brown Professor in the Department of Geosciences and Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Arizona in Tucson. He's co-director of the Institute of the Environment. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure. Thanks.
This has been the first in a series of interviews with speakers from the Kivira Coalition Conference. Please stay tuned for the next 2 Mondays to hear the rest, and check out their website, kiviracoalition.org. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafemc. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news, then jazz.